Today is Easter, and Easter's always a fun time of year, right? The weather's getting warmer, there's buds appearing on all the trees, and the flowers will be coming up soon. We don't see them yet, but we know they're going to be coming up soon. And I loved Easter as a kid, because I remember coming down the stairs in my house, and there's a basket there, and there was a big blow-up Easter bunny. I think we've got a picture of this. There we go. Yeah. That's me at 1.5 years old, and there was always a basket full of candy. There would be lots of chocolate, and my favorite, jelly beans, right? Old-fashioned jelly beans. Now, who likes jelly beans? Anybody? Yes. Who likes the best flavor, the black licorice ones? Yes, come on. The black licorice ones, and then the red cherry ones. Those are the two best, right? And I should say, I gave up sweets during Lent, and so this bowl isn't going to last the rest of today, because I love jelly beans. Now, I also remember as a kid going to church. I grew up going to church, and Easter's like the main event, right? It's the biggest Sunday of the year, and we would get super dressed up, and we would always take pictures. And this was after church at somebody's house one day. We were eating dinner there. Someone who apparently has ceramic Easter bunnies. and that's me and my sister. You got to love the pose. And the yellow pants, they're awesome. So, but we would go to church and we would take these pictures. And we can take that picture down now. And we'd take these pictures. But I remember going to church and we would sing hymns. We would sing hymns like the one we sang a little bit ago, Christ the Lord is Risen Today. And there would always be an Easter sermon, right? And Jesus always rose from the grave on Easter. And we would always hear about the empty tomb. And for me as a kid, here's what I think I learned about Easter, or here's what I took away, or here's what I thought Easter proved. Easter proved that Jesus is really God. Because anybody that can pull off their own resurrection, right, is God. And so it proved Jesus is really God. It proved death is really bad. It's something to overcome, right? And it proves that heaven is really real. Just the way God rose, raised Jesus from the dead, he's going to raise us from the dead one day. So Jesus is God, death is bad, and heaven is real. Those were the truths I learned. And at some level, I still believe those things, but I'm not sure they're enough, right? Because you grow up and you go to middle school, or you go to high school and things kind of get tough and you face interesting new challenges. And then you go off to college, or you get a job, or you go into a career, and maybe you have a family, and you face all sorts of new things for which that childhood version of the Easter story just doesn't seem like it's enough. Those truths don't seem to meet you in all the difficulties and all the complex things that you face. And in some ways, that version of the Easter story becomes a bit like a bowl of old-fashioned jelly beans, right? It's sweet. It's comforting. It's endearing. There's a sense of nostalgia there. And one Sunday out of the year, we indulge ourselves on these truths, just like I'm going to indulge myself this afternoon, right? These truths that Jesus is God and death is bad and heaven is real. But you can't really live on that version of the Easter story. It doesn't nourish you. It doesn't really feed you. It doesn't really sustain you. You might get a sugar high on Easter Sunday with it, but it doesn't really help you out in the long run. It doesn't help you out when you face the tough questions and doubts and difficulties of life. But fortunately, there's more to the Easter story than what I learned as a kid. It's not that what I learned was wrong. I just don't think it was enough. I don't think it fully explains what God was doing. I don't think it fully explains what God was actually up to on Easter. You see, if Good Friday and Easter Sunday are just like a bowl of jelly beans, there's this sort of sweet truth in there, I don't think that really serves us throughout our whole lives. It doesn't really meet us in an entire journey of faith, but I think there's more that we can learn. I think wherever you are in your journey of faith, maybe you've been following Jesus for 40 years, Maybe you've just been following him for 40 days. Maybe you still have 40 questions or objections or doubts for why you're not really buying it, why you can't fully believe it. I want to reread the Easter story this morning, and I want to point out what I think are some more profound and deeper truths that actually meet us in the everyday things we face in life. On Friday, after Jesus was crucified, a couple of his followers took his body down from the cross, his limp, dead body. They anointed it with some oils and prepared the body for burial with some oils, and they wrapped it in cloths, and then they laid it in a tomb, a small cave that was nearby. And you can only imagine the emotions they must have felt as they were doing this. I mean, think about the shock and the horror of this unexpected death of someone, and it hadn't been days. They hadn't really had time to mourn. It had just been minutes or hours. And some of us know what that's like. You've received terrible news of somebody close to you suddenly passing away, but this wasn't like a car accident. They saw a mob murder him. They saw him executed as a criminal of the state, and they were his followers. So mixed in with shock and deep sadness and mourning and all of these, and anger, had to have been fear as well. Just all of the deepest and darkest emotions somebody could experience. They experienced that Friday night. Stories are all silent on Saturday. We don't know what happened then. They're just silent. But then early Sunday morning, this is what John tells us. He says this: early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene, who was one of Jesus' followers, went to the tomb, and she saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one that Jesus loved. That's John. He's writing this, by the way. He calls himself the one Jesus loved. And this is what Mary Magdalene said to them: they've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. So Mary goes to the tomb, and there's indications she wasn't alone. Maybe she went with a couple of other women. There's some other stories about the resurrection, but we're not sure why she went that morning, but she goes to the tomb, and immediately when she gets there, she realizes something is wrong because the doorway is open and it shouldn't have been. The stone that had been in front of the cave had been pushed away and it shouldn't have been. And she knows immediately that somebody has vandalized the tomb. And she can't believe it. Why would someone steal his body? I mean, how horrible to add that kind of insult to injury. Or maybe the Roman authorities are the ones that took it. Maybe they didn't want anyone turning Jesus into a martyr and people coming to his grave to worship him there. And so maybe they're the ones that took it. But how horrible for her to experience that. And so she immediately runs to tell the other disciples. But before we move on, don't overlook what it says in the beginning of that passage. Let's put the passage back up there for a second. It says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. That's important. See, it was still dark. It was physically still dark. She had to probably light a torch to make her way and fumble her way through the dark. And it wouldn't have been like it is here where at nighttime there's city lights and things. All it would have been really, really dark. And so she's fumbling her way towards the tomb in the dark. And the sun had not yet risen. Preacher joke there. S-U-N. Sun, right? Seriously, the sun. The actual sun had not come. It was dark. It wasn't just physically dark. It was emotionally dark, right? Psychologically and spiritually, it was dark for her. It was cold. God had been silent. And in her pain and in her anguish and in her mourning and in everything she was feeling, she goes to the tomb in the dark. And yet God, in the darkness, in the coldness of the tomb, in the quietness, God was working, right? And I think that's the first profound truth that we need to learn, or we need to remind ourselves from this story, and it's that God works in the dark. And I don't think most of us actually believe that. I mean, that makes for a nice little slogan, right, that we could put somewhere or put on Facebook or something like that. But I don't know how many of us actually believe God works in the darkest and the loneliest and the hardest and the coldest and the most difficult seasons of our lives. Because you know what? We can't see him working in the dark. We don't feel him working in the dark. We don't experience him working in the dark. Nobody saw what happened that morning. It's not like thunder was happening and lightning was happening and the angels were there and there was this big countdown, like before Jesus comes out, like 10, 9, 8. Like, it wasn't like that. It was dark and nothing to all of our understanding was happening. See, we don't experience it or know it or feel it or see it. And when we go through these challenges in life, and if you've been here over the last several weeks during Lent, we've been calling this like wilderness seasons. When you go through one of those seasons, you know, a week where you have a really bad week and just everything's going wrong, or you have a really bad month or a really bad year, right? Or there's just a relationship in your life and it's all going wrong there, or there's something that's happened and you've lost something, or you want something and you just can't have it and nothing seems to get, and it feels like you're walking through the wilderness and you're alone and it's dark. And in those moments, it's easy to stop and think, you know what? Is this whole thing about there's actually a God up there somewhere and he loves me and cares about me, is it just a big fairy tale? I'm sure that's what Mary Magdalene was thinking. She was stumbling towards the tomb that morning because it was still dark. And that's one of the mysteries, I think, of Easter. We almost never see it. We almost never experience it. But in the moment, we have to somehow learn to trust God's working in the dark, even though we can't see it. And even though we can't even be assured everything's going to be okay, just wait a couple of days, just wait a few weeks, just wait a few months. Everything. We can never be assured of that, but somehow we've got to have faith and believe God can work and is working even when everything is dark. Well, look at what she does. She goes back and she tells Peter and John, and look at what happens next. It says this, so Peter and the other disciple, remember, that's John. He's writing this himself, so that's him. Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. So he's thinking, I just want to clear this up for people reading this in the future, because people are going to be wondering, who's the fastest disciple? And everyone's going to think it's Peter, right? Because Peter's like the one who has all the answers, and he becomes the first pope, and like all these things. They're going to think it's Peter, but I just want to clear it up. On Sunday morning, Easter morning, when we started running at the same time, one disciple got there a whole lot faster than the other, right? So he says, he reached the tomb first. He bent over, and he looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him, right? Just remember, and he went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. And the cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who, by the way, had reached the tomb first, also went inside. And he saw and believed. And at that point, it's not even clear what he believed, because then John tells us, parenthetically, right? They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. They didn't have all their answers. They didn't know what it all meant. They didn't put it all together. They just knew something had happened. A miracle had happened. And so then the disciples went back to where they were staying. Now in the meantime, as John and Peter head back, Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb again. And they don't pass each other on the road, or maybe she takes a different route. We don't know. But she goes to the tomb, and she still thinks the body has been taken. And this is what happens. It says, now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. And they asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." And at this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. And he asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it that you're looking for?" Now, the term "woman" here isn't disrespectful. It sounds kind of harsh to us, but that was an endearing term in that culture. Jesus said that to his own mother. But here's something I don't want you to miss, because I think John is trying to point it out to us. Four times we're told in this little section that she's crying, right? When she first gets there, it says she's standing outside the tomb and she's crying. And then when she goes in the tomb, she's still weeping. And that's probably the better word actually here, because in Greek, this was originally written in Greek, there's actually two words that are often used to describe crying. The first word is an expression that's a more visible word. It's when you see tears streaming down someone's face. Something has moved them, or something has saddened them or grieved them, and they begin crying, and you can actually see them shedding tears. The second word is more audible crying. It's when you can hear the person crying, because they are weeping and wailing and sobbing so much out loud that you can hear it. That's the word that's used here of Mary Magdalene. She is weeping and sobbing. And so then she sees these two men. She doesn't know they're angels, right? She doesn't even know who they are. And they ask her, "Why are you crying or weeping?" And then she sees this third man, and we don't know if she just sees him out of the corner of her eye or what, but she doesn't know it's Jesus. She doesn't recognize. And he says to her, "Why are you crying?" But he adds another question, almost as if he's saying, "What's happened? Why is your heart broken? What are you missing? What are you looking for?" Or more specifically, "Who are you looking for?" You see, what I think we learn in this part of the story is not just that God works in the dark, but that God hears our cries. He hears our cries. When we cry out to him, or even when we just cry out, in the same way when the Israelites cried out in Egypt, God heard their cries. Something took place a couple of weeks before the cross. Jesus was out teaching, and he was in a village in Israel, and he's teaching, and he receives words from some good friends of his. He has these good friends, Lazarus and Lazarus's two sisters, and he receives word from Lazarus's two sisters that Lazarus is really sick. Like, not just kind of sick, but deathly sick, serious condition sick, might not make it through the night sick. "So we need you to come, Jesus, as fast as possible." Because remember, Jesus is the great healer. Jesus is the miracle worker. That's what he's known for more than anything else, is healing people of their sickness. And so these sisters say to him, "Jesus, come as quick as you can, because he might not make it through the night. And we know if you come, you can heal him and make him better." And so Jesus goes to visit Lazarus 5 days later. And when he gets there, the sisters approach him. And they basically say this: "Thanks for coming, Jesus. You're 4 days late. Lazarus died 4 days ago. Why weren't you here? Where were you? Why didn't you? We told you. You loved him. You love us, right? Why didn't you come? You could have come. And if you had been here, you could have healed him. You could have saved him. That's what you do. He would be alive today if you had come." And one of the sisters gets so moved at this point that John tells us she begins to weep. The second kind. She's weeping uncontrollably. And her family and her friends are there, and we're told that they begin weeping and wailing as well. And in that moment, John says that something stirs so deep inside of Jesus, something moves in him, that he begins to weep with them. You see, God hears our cries. And he doesn't just say, you know what, just shake it off. It's not that bad, right? It's going to get bad. Just, sisters, just wait 10 minutes. Everything's going to be like, I'm going to do something. It's going to be all okay. He doesn't say that, right? I sometimes say that to my kids, right? Just shake it off. It's not that bad. You're not even bleeding. Quit crying, right? I'm a great dad. God doesn't do that with us. He cries with us. He weeps with us. He hears our cries. And even for Mary Magdalene that day, Jesus looked at her and he said, what's going on? What's behind all this? What's at the bottom of all this? What are you looking for? What are you really longing for? Who is it that you're looking for? And look at how she responds. It says this, thinking that he was the gardener. She said, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him. And Jesus said to her, Mary. He called her name. And she turned toward him, and she cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. You see, she knew it was Jesus when he called her specific name. Just like a few weeks before, Jesus called out Lazarus' name. And when Jesus called Lazarus' specific name, he rose from the dead and came back to life. And in these two stories, if we step back for a second, we see Jesus is not just this grand savior for all of humanity. Jesus actually knows all of our names. And he calls us by name. He knows your name and yours and yours and yours and yours and yours. Like every single mine, he knows all of our names, and he calls us by name. But don't miss this, because there's one little detail that John gives us in the story, and we just skip right over it. We just think it's coincidental, but I don't think it is. What did she mistake Jesus for? You can answer that. A gardener. Do you know why? Because they were in a garden. In fact, John tells us in the chapter before where Jesus was buried, he says this in John 19, at the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. A garden is where you plant seeds of hope. That's what you do when you plant seeds, because you take these seeds that you can get at Home Depot, right? And they're in this little envelope here, and they're basically dead. They're disconnected from the plant or the bush or the flower that they were originally connected to. And as long as they just sit in this envelope, nothing's going to happen. But when you bury them deep in the ground, and then you wait expectantly with hope, we all know what happens in a garden. New life eventually springs forth. And Jesus himself alluded to this process a week before his death. When he came into Jerusalem that last week of his life, he turned to his disciples, and this is what he said in John 12. He said, very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies... And the implication is if it dies and it's buried, and then you wait and you trust and you hope, then it produces many seeds. You see, God works in the dark, and God hears our cries, but God also plants seeds of hope. And nobody could have expected this, and nobody could have anticipated it, and nobody thought anything like this was ever going to happen. But what God was doing was he was taking Jesus' death, and he was going to bring about new life and plant seeds of hope, not just for Jesus and not just for those of us who trust in Jesus and believe in Jesus. Yes, we believe one day that we'll rise again like Jesus will, but God was actually planting seeds of hope in this entire world. And that means so much to us for all of the little deaths that we die every single day. Because we die deaths every day. I die deaths to my ego. We die deaths to our reputation. We die death to our expectations, to our dreams, to all of our plans of how we think our life is going to unfold perfectly, to ourselves, to our selfishness. We die those deaths every single day. But you see, if the Easter story is only about, well, Jesus rose from the grave, so good news is we're all going to get to go to heaven when we die one day. Well, then the little deaths that we die every day are just things to overcome. They're just frustrations in life. They're just problems that we need to figure out how to solve. But maybe, maybe God is planting a garden in our lives. And maybe he's planting seeds of hope. And maybe we need to take those seeds and let them die. And take our egos and our selfishness and all of the stuff. And maybe sometimes he looks at us, he says, you just got to let that die and you got to bury it. And I know it's hard. And I know this one's really important to you. But if you do, if you'll trust, and it might take a while, right? It might be a long winter. It might be a cold winter. And it might be a dark winter. And you're not going to see anything happening under the ground for months. But if you trust and believe, and I can bring forth new life that's better than anything that you could ever imagine. So here's the challenge this morning. If you're here today and you've been holding out with God on a part of your life, or maybe just your whole heart and your whole life, right? You've been coming to church for a while, because it's good for the kids, or it's good for the family, or maybe you grew up going to church and you've been coming back, or maybe you get something out of it, or maybe you just pop in every now and then, whatever it is. But you would say, and you know deep down, you're still kind of holding God at arm's length, and you're not fully buying it, right? Because you have all kinds of questions. What if Jesus is calling your name today? Your specific name. Because guess what? He called Lazarus' name, and Lazarus was dead. He was dead. And he made him alive again. And what if he wants to do that in your life today? And what if something is in there that you need to die to? Maybe it's your pride. Maybe it's your stubbornness. Maybe it's your holding out or your defensive nature. And I'm not just picking on you if that's you, because that's me too. Because I still hold God at arm's length sometimes, and I still have pride that I have a hard time dying to. But I've found that when I die to it, and when I hand it over and I trust in God, that he can bring something forth that's so much more beautiful and so much better than I could have ever imagined. Maybe you're here today and you've been a Christian for quite a while, but I don't think the challenge for you is any different. I think the challenge for all of us is to participate in Jesus' death daily so that we can also participate in his resurrection life daily. And you know what I love about this story? Mary Magdalene, she runs back and she tells everybody she sees the good news. Because Jesus is alive, and that means he can make me alive, and that means everything is different. God actually was working in the dark. And God was actually hearing our cries. And God was actually planting seeds of hope, even though we didn't know it. And Lazarus does the same thing. When God raises Lazarus from the dead, Lazarus goes around and he tells everybody. He can't stop talking about it because he is a walking reflection of the Easter story, not just for one Sunday out of the year, but the entire year. He is a demonstration that God is always working in the dark. That God hears our cries, and that God is planting seeds of hope. Let me pray for us. Father God, help us to trust you with our lives. Help us to trust you with the things that are dead, or the things in our lives that need to die. Help us to trust you in the wilderness. Even in the good times, with the blessings, and with the everything you give us, God. Help us to remember that the life comes from you. And the grace and the love that we experience and the blessings we experience ultimately come from you. And whatever it is that we might feel like is bringing us down right now, or whatever tomb we feel like we might be stuck in right now, I pray that you would help us to call out to you and remember that you have called out to us and that you can rescue us and you can make us alive in the same way you made your own son alive. I pray all this in your name. Amen.